Well, welcome back to Coast with Mark Jacobson. We're going to take your phone calls as we talk about his work, Pale Horse Rider. It's all about William Cooper. If you knew of William Cooper, check in with us as well. Love to get your comments. George Norrie back with you. Mark Jacobson with us. We'll get to your calls too. Mark, your book, Pale Horse Rider, is very thorough about Bill Cooper. What did you do or where did you go for your resources for the accuracy that you've got in your book?
Well, I mean, I listened to Cooper's got there. If you look at the Hour of the Time website, which is the name of his radio show, there are 1,926 shows that Cooper did, which are listed there, and you can listen to all of them. I mean, a lot of them are repeats, but there's at least 1,000 or maybe 1,200 of original shows there. I listened to a fair amount of those, and, you know, I spoke to everybody that enormous amounts of people that actually met Cooper personally. Norio Hayakawa, George Knapp, actually.
Oh, one of our guys.
Yeah, one of your guys. So, like, and several people who I talked to, and I went out and spent a long time in Igar, which is where Cooper was lived and did his show, and lived on top of a lonely mountaintop there. It's not really a mountaintop. It's more of a hillside, but and Cooper's discussing it, it became bigger and bigger every day. And I talked to the people that lived with him, and it was fascinating to me. And actually, it was being from New York, and I found it to be kind of one of these transformative kind of experiences, because people have certain attitudes about where they're from and what they think, but when I began to get into Bill Cooper and meet the people that, you know, believe the things he said or like were interested in the things he said, it really expanded my entire outlook on the world in general. And I found it to be very uplifting.
How would you categorize it, Mark, other than his wildness, of course? Would you say he was pretty intuitive, that he was accurate? What would you say?
Well, I'd say that he was somebody who had a really firm idea about, he was a seeker. Now, somebody who really wanted to, I think it, one thing that I think is really different between Bill Cooper and some of the people that followed him, I won't mention any names, is that he actually was seeking a certain degree of truth that made sense. His most famous commentary, and probably the most valuable thing he ever did, was to say, do your own research. Now, the idea of, like,
don't believe
everything, talk to everybody, don't believe anything until you can prove it with your own research to your own satisfaction that it's so. And there's a lot of leeway in that comment, but it really gets people who ordinarily wouldn't bother to get off their behinds to find out anything new other than the fact what they saw on television to seek out different sources of information. I think that's all healthy.
I think so, too. Let's take some calls while we continue chatting. And, oh, by the way, the book, where do people get it, Mark?
Well, you can get it in any bookstore, and you can get it on Amazon. If you want to enrich Jeff Bezos, go right ahead.
By the way, I want you as a regular guest on the show, so every time you come out with another publication or something that you could be a resource for us, I want to put you on the show. I'd like you.
That'll be great. I mean, as I told you, I'm a listener, and I'm very happy to be here. So anytime you want to call me up in the middle of the night
and wake you up
in the morning here.
That's right.
I got my little cup of coffee. You know, I'm good.
Let's go to Jeff in Santa Rosa, California, west of the Rockies, to get things started. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, how you guys doing?
All right. Thanks.
I actually heard Bill Cooper speak personally. Once was at the Evergreen State College in Washington, the state of Washington. I think it was in 91, right after, sometime shortly after his book came out. And then again at Salt Lake City at some survival thing that he was invited to.
At the Salt Dome?
I don't know what the name of it was. I don't remember, actually. I was working there. And he was headlining with Bo Gritz. So if anybody saw Bo Gritz talking about,
I'm aware of that particular speech.
What did you think of him, Jeff?
Bill Cooper or Bull Gritz?
Cooper.
Cooper.
Bill Cooper was one of the most energetic men that I have ever met in my life. He was very professional. I was impressed with I wasn't even going to go talk to him at the or listen to him speak at the Evergreen Straight College, but somebody dragged me along. I'd never heard of him before. And I said, oh, you got to hear this guy. So I went out there, and he was one patriotic guy. At that time, I think it was in 1991. And he said that he worked for Naval Intelligence, and you have to be, to get picked for Naval Intelligence, you almost always have to say that you were part of some secret group like the Masons or something like that. He wasn't a Mason, but he was something else. I don't remember what he said.
He actually was a member as a youth. He was a member of the Demolay Society.
He did say that he worked for an admiral of the Pacific Fleet, and his job in Naval Intelligence was to read through all of these very detailed and hidden papers that nobody gets to see, and then summarize it for the admiral.
Yep, that's exactly what we did.
Paragraphs.
Yep, exactly. Yep. But I got to tell you, Mark, when this is what I hear, when Cooper drank, he was a wild man.
Well, that was his big demon. I mean, I can't tell you. I talked to a few of his ex-wives, and they all said that it was two different people there. I mean, there was the
Jekyll and Hyde, wasn't he?
Well, that's what they said. I mean, they almost used that phrase. I mean, it was uncanny how many people said exactly the same thing. So I would tend to believe that. And when he's drinking, he was one person completely. You know, and really, not somebody that you really wanted to mess with much. And when he was not drinking, he'd be just the most cheerful and...
docile and everything else, wasn't he?
Yeah, just a great guy, somebody who liked to tell jokes. And he had a fantastic sense of humor and a great, great taste in music, I must say. That's one of the best things about his show, the songs he would play. Some of them, which would be things you would never expect, you know?
Yeah. Next up, Joe in Long Island, New York. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Hi, Mark. I know you have an entertaining day coming up, but on your book, my question would be, I can understand how JFK's assassination would have induced paranoia in a lot of people. It seemed to be an in-house job with not a clear explanation at the time. I can understand how the Vietnam War would have induced paranoia. Because what were we doing there? I know there was, at the time, oil in Indonesia that maybe Big Oil wanted to, you know, keep the communists at bay from getting down into Indonesia. And that's about the only explanation that sounds plausible for the Vietnam War. But my question would be, in a general sense, what do you think induces paranoia? Is it the idea that the government is going to turn on people and they need to be armed at a personal level? Is it, I don't think the Illuminati induces paranoia, but what do you think is some of the overriding causes of people like Mr. Cooper being somewhat paranoid? And maybe he was right. Maybe they were after him.
Well, you know what they say about paranoids, just because you don't think they're out to get you doesn't mean they're not. So I think that these ideas of paranoia, I mean, there's clinical paranoia, which, you know, people need to have treatment for, and there's also cultural paranoia, which is sort of in this society. There's always been a kind of feeling of distrust about maybe outsiders, and, you know, it's run through the waves of this country has gone through many different waves of that kind of stuff. We may be in one now, and I think what Cooper believed is that the world is getting worse, you know, all the time. He was a pessimistic guy in a lot of ways, and he felt that it was not the fault of human beings necessarily, that there was somebody who was fixing it, like the world was fixed, like it would be going, like going to the racetrack, and you know what horse is going to win. And some people know and some don't. So the fools would bet on, the sheeple would bet on whatever horse looked good to them in the paddock, and the insiders would know who was going to win. So that kind of thing, it makes you, it eats away at your trust as that things are on the level. And once you believe that things are no longer on the level, I think that some people, you know, people have a lot of imagination, and as this imagination begins to take over, you know, it's like some people, you know what the phrase, imagining the worst?
Yep.
I mean, some people just are very adept at imagining the worst, and I think that that becomes a kind of paranoid thing in itself. But the fact is that is it paranoid if it turns out to be true? I mean, if it turns out that, like, actually some people are said, the way the things are set up are set up to keep you from realizing your full potential, and that actually is a fact, does that make you a paranoid person, or does that make you somebody who can, like, say, well, gee whiz, I mean, this is just not right? And I think that was what Cooper felt, is that something's not right. You know, something is not right. Every day that I wake up, I feel a little less free than I did yesterday. And somebody's doing this. It's not just me. It's somebody, it's an outside force. And I think that when you talk about paranoia, it's a big topic, and I think people throw around that word quite loosely, and I don't think that's quite right. You have to really look into what you mean by a phrase like that.
When 9/11 occurred, and they quickly named Osama bin Laden as the culprit, the person who masterminded the thing, along with his buddies, what did Bill Cooper say?
Well, Bill Cooper's on the radio. Cooper went on the radio on the day of actual 9/11. I mean, it's actually in the first chapter of my book, because I thought it was one of the most interesting things that he did. You know, he had already predicted that Osama bin Laden was going to be blamed.
Right, years before.
So, you know, that years before, and then reiterated it again in that broadcast at the end of June.
Yes.
So it was very fresh in his mind that this is the way he felt about it. So then the planes supposedly fly into the building. I mean, the planes fly into the building. I mean, I was there that day. I was sent down there. I covered it. I was right there. You know, I walked through it was so chaotic that I actually walked through the police line. They hadn't been able to set it up yet, and I walked down there, I just assumed that the buildings would look like a fallen over tree, like you see the stump, but actually it was completely flat. And I asked a fireman, like, where's the buildings? And he said, they're underneath your feet. And it was like...
Made no sense, did it?
Well, it was just an incredible thing. I mean, if you're born in New York, and you grew up here, and you're looking at those buildings every day, and suddenly they're not
gone
anymore.
Yeah.
it's a meaningful event. But to get to the back to the what Cooper was saying on the radio that day was, well, if the planes flew into the buildings and the government had no warning, and every single one of the guys that were part of the thing are dead. How do they know that Osama bin Laden did it? Because, you know, he was listening to BBC, and he's listening to Richard Pearl, who was one of the Bush guys, if you remember him.
Yep.
And Ahud Barak, who was the former prime minister of Israel.
Of Israel, that's right.
And they're saying, well, it was obviously Osama bin Laden, you know, and I think that we should bomb Afghanistan if you would do a few things like that to make sure that we get back at these guys. So Cooper breaks right into the broadcast and says, how do they know who did it? How do they know? You know, and that was the right question to ask, I think. You know, like, how do they know? I mean, is there
anything? Unless they had prior knowledge.
Well, I mean, you know, that's what the conclusion that most people might come to. But he was on it. He had that thing wired from the beginning. He saw it happening, and... I think, and he's actually the person who really kind of more or less invented 9/11 truth, because he's sitting there watching it in real time, and he's saying things like inside job, controlled demolition, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, way before anybody even brought that stuff up.
Oh, no. I mean, it was like this kind of stuff didn't really begin to peak, because I did a story about it in 2005. That was 4 years later. And this was all supposedly new at the time. But Cooper is looking at it in real time, watching it on television, and saying there must have been these charges that were, like, set in the building, all the kind of stuff that later people were saying all over the place. You know, he was intuitive about...
Yeah, he sure was.
He really was intuitive about what people were going to think.
And then he's dead 2 months later.
Well, that is one of the great things about Bill Cooper's... I would call it his legend. It could have just been a coincidence, but it that's the way these things, that's the way people become folk heroes, I think. I mean, Bill Cooper is sort of a folk, he is a folk hero. And, you know, the fact that he's dead 2 months later, really even less than 2 months later, he predicts 9/11 happening, he predicts his own death, and they both happen. So, I mean, you know, for a lot of people, you know, I'm a journalist, I'm a straight down the middle kind of guy, you know. I like to look at the facts. I've been, you know, done all kinds of stories about all kinds of things, you know, not just this kind of stuff. And, you know, you look at it and you go like, wow, you know, it's kind of curious.
What compelled him, Mark, to shoot the sheriff deputy in the head?
Well, I don't think that Bill Cooper was thinking very clearly at this point.
No, something was wrong.
I think that Cooper was, he had convinced himself that they were coming up there to kill him. He kind of willed it all to happen. I mean, you read the book, you can see he went through. I mean, I know that the Cooper fans are probably not going to be happy with this, but he went through a lot of machinations to kind of like set up his own situation.
That he almost created his own demise. You're saying?
Well, they have this phrase, "suicide by cop." This is one of the most convoluted suicide by cop things you might run across, and I'm not saying that that's what happened. I'm just looking at the facts and laying them out.
He wasn't wealthy, was he?
No. He was always worried about money.
Yeah.
Never had any money. His like house was falling apart. The house, he lived on top of a hill with a great view, but actually the house itself was dilapidated.
Yeah.
He was living up there, and it was like he had this kind of instinct as a hoarder. It was completely filled up with stuff that he would order on eBay. And, you know, it's just this kind of picturesque kind of thing where a guy is up on top of a hill in the middle of basically nowhere broadcasting about saying what he believes to be the truth and what many people do believe the truth is the truth. And he thinks the cops are out to get him, and they actually are.
Yeah, they are out to get him. Now, there was a
little... It becomes this kind of like almost, it sounds like a movie to me, but all that stuff is the way it went down. And Cooper.
By the way, this book should be made into a movie because I think it would be a blockbuster.
Well, I would hope that would happen, but you know,
see what happens.
You know, to me, it's just sort of like I'm somebody who's interested in the soul of the America. I'm an American, you know, like everybody else lives in this country.
You don't have a website, do you?
No, I don't.
You may be the only guest I've ever had who doesn't have a website.
Well, I don't care about that kind of stuff. Are you?
Are you on social?
I got an Instagram account. People could follow me.
Yeah. What about Facebook? Are you on that?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, and I got an Instagram account which it's called Pale Horse Rider Book, in which I've tried to do a pictorial history of William Cooper and his life and times. So people could look at it.
All right. Well, we're going to come back in a moment with Mark Jacobson, author of Pale Horse Rider, and take final phone calls here as we talk about the very perplexing life of William Cooper. I mean, a very perplexing guy who was very intuitive. I hope you heard the clip that I played an hour plus ago with him talking about the 1997 CNN interview, 1997, with Osama bin Laden. Well, next hour we talk about the incredible story of Coral Castle, so make sure you're part of the program, and we're going to come back in a moment and finish up our phone calls with Mark Jacobson, author of Pale Horse Rider, The Story of William Cooper. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're back with Mark Jacobson and his book, Pale Horse Rider, our final segment here. Let's go right to the calls. Linda in Auburn, Washington, west of the Rockies. Hi, Linda. Go ahead.
Hello, George. I'm glad you took my call.
Of course.
My stomach's churning with the sadness about what Bill Cooper had to go through, because he was truly a truth seeker. And after hearing Rachel last night revealing truth, it just shows how painful it is, how the truth can be so heartbreakingly painful to know that there is someone or someone's who don't believe in the sanctity of life, but I wanted to ask Mr. Jacobs about the Oklahoma bombing and if Bill Cooper ever said anything about that, because I'm sorry to say this, but I think that it was done to divert attention from the Clintons, who were under investigation and could possibly lose the White House. And they killed babies, were killed in that. And I just wanted to know, since Bill Cooper was fighting for the truth, did he say anything about it?
Well, he knew Timothy McVeigh, of course, who I believe still was the one who did the original bombing of the Oklahoma City bombing. And, Mark, let's bring you in on that.
Well, I mean, to continue the story that I was telling before about when the two guys came to visit Cooper, I mean, the last thing they said as they drove away in a car, this is several months before the bombing, somebody yelled out the window, "Watch Oklahoma City." That's Cooper's account of the meeting. "Watch Oklahoma City." So Bill Cooper believed that Timothy McVeigh was a kind of a robot, a kind of like a Manchurian candidate kind of figure, who was either had nothing to do with it or was programmed to do what he did. Cooper also believed that the bombing in Oklahoma City was similar to what happened on a much larger scale in 9/11, which was an inside job.
Mm-hmm.
He did believe that the Oklahoma bombing was set up to incriminate and make the Patriot movement look bad, and he also believed that partially, and this is one of the something that he often said, that these things are often staged to be able to have government repression in response to it. In other words, there was a thing called the Omnibus Crime Bill, I think.
I remember that.
And that was on the table before Oklahoma City, and it passed right away after that. And in a similar and situation was the Patriot Act.
Well, look what happened to that, how quickly that got passed.
I don't believe that anybody in the Congress ever read the Patriot Act before they passed it.
Well, no, they probably just rubber stamped it.
Well, it was 2,000 pages long, all of a sudden they were tracking what books you took out of the library and all kinds of stuff like that. And people, and then also, this is called the Patriot Act, you have to be for it, right? So, I think the ladies, the caller's feelings are justified in that, in the sense that, whether or not these things actually, whatever happened, there are forces to take advantage of them, take advantage, like, say 9/11 happens and it's exactly as the official story says. 19 guys with box cutters, the government didn't know anything about it. Even if that's the truth, everything was set up to go, go. There was no trial. I mean, I think what Bill Cooper said, which I think was really something I completely agree with, said what they should do, if you got a guy like Osama bin Laden, you send your guys in there, your SWAT team, you pull the guy back here, you put him on trial the way it says in the Constitution, and he's either convicted by a jury of his peers or not. And then you do what you did. You don't kill him like 30 years later and throw his body in the ocean. I mean, because it just breeds this kind of distrust and makes everybody... It just looks bad, and it's just a bad thing to do. It's not the way the Constitution is supposed to work.
Why is everybody at this point so conspiratorial whenever anything happens? I mean, anything.
Well, the government, I guess, if they've always been lying, I don't know. I mean, have the corporations always been lying? I mean, are they telling you that, like, you should go out and smoke cigarettes because it's really good for your health? And getting football players to go on in my mind. I remember Paul Harding, the football player.
Oh, sure.
He was a famous football player.
Green Bay Packers, right?
Green Bay Packers. He's doing these commercials for cigarettes, you know, and saying, well, these are really helping me score more touchdowns. I mean, you know, this is this kind of world that we're living in. So, you know, people have wised up to the point where they're not going to believe that. So, I mean, a lot of people still do, but a lot of people don't.
And, right.
You know, so therefore, you know, but the people still need answers. They need explanations. They need to feel that, like, things are not happening by random. If you believe that everything happens randomly, you know, and you don't really have any control over the universe, I mean, that's a really kind of frightening idea. I think people want to have a rationale about, well, this happened and this is why it happened. And then if you can't believe in any authorities, you'll come up with your own theories about this kind of stuff. And some of the theories begin to coalesce into a kind of critical mass where you get a lot of people believing that X, Y, and Z happened. And then you've got this conspiracy theory, and I don't buy this idea of conspiracy theory. I mean, this is an alternative history to a kind of history that is being pushed by people by the historians, who are obviously you know, it's been proved over and over again. It's, you know, you go to the cowboy movie, and they're telling you that well, you know, the Indians are the bad guys, and now then you grow up and you realize, well, what did they do to be the bad guys? So you know, I think a lot of the stuff, historical stuff that we've been told, has been proven to be flawed. So people want to know what really happened. And they come up with, you know, the human mind is an amazing thing. It's the most incredible thing in the universe. And it can think, and it can come up with stories. Making stories is the most human thing that you can do.
Let's go to your neck of the woods in Brooklyn, New York.
All right, Brooklyn, BK.
John's with us, first-time caller. Hi, John, go ahead.
Hey, Mark. Hey, George, how we doing?
Great, thank you.
Fellow New Yorker, as George said. I just wanted to say that I'm a longtime follower of William Cooper. I own his book, Behold the Pale Horse. And I think it's a great thing that you're actually writing a book, basically going into at least the latter half of his life story and, you know, the research he's done and that sort of thing. And I just wanted to commend you for that. I put out an album. I'm happen to be an artist and a recording engineer and music producer. I happen to have put out an album in 2011 called A Fiery Red Horse, which was actually inspired by William Cooper and his book and his radio broadcasts. And there's I throw a lot of esoteric messages in there, and it's on iTunes. It's under the name MC Too Tall because you know, rappers can't use their government names.
That's right.
You're not supposed to use your government name. So you know who the Wu-Tang Clan is, right?
Well, oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I'm good friends with ODB's son, Young Dirty Bastard.
Oh, really? That's interesting. I actually ran into him one time. But, you know, I mean, it's... I mean, what you're saying is kind of interesting because I think that... Yeah, Bill Cooper had fans everywhere. I mean, they weren't just...
And it was growing, wasn't it?
Well, it was. I don't know how much it was growing, because, I mean, he had a lot of trouble with his... I mean, I'm sure you understand this, George. He was originally on this thing called WWCR, which has a huge transmitter.
Mm-hmm.
100,000 watts, you know, big. And he was on there, and he reached a lot of people. And then after he lost that slot, he was always scrambling for some kind of satellite hookup.
Right. See, now he'd be podcasting.
But I think that when he lived, that's one of the most important things about the Bill Cooper story. He predates the broadband idea. He predates a lot of the, I mean, Rush Limbaugh was around, but
He predated our friend Alex Jones.
Alex Jones went to school on Bill Cooper.
Yeah.
I mean, we were talking about me listening to Long John Neville underneath the covers. That's exactly what Alex Jones did with Bill Cooper. He's growing up as a kind of frat boy, with, you know, soon to be frat boy in Austin, Texas, and listening to William Cooper. In fact,
that's what he called Ted Cruz, frat boy.
Well, in any event, I one thing I would have to give Alex Cooper is, Alex Jones, is that he's the only one who did any meaningful reporting on Bill Cooper's death.
Yeah.
He called up the night that Cooper was killed and talked to several of the residents in that town. It's in the book. You can read it. And
but you know what? As I've told Alex, not everything's a conspiracy. I mean, Alex... Alex has admitted,
business, George.
Alex has admitted on the show that he made a mistake with regards to the Sandy Hook tragedy, school shooting.
That's a sheer cruelty. How can you talk to a person whose kid just got killed and tell them that it didn't really happen? I mean, you know, it's sort of like, you know, I don't know. I mean, to me, that's beyond what should be done, you know.
But he admitted he was wrong. You know, which,
no, I think it's great that he admitted that he was wrong. But, you know, but I mean, but Bill Cooper was really Alex Jones's idol.
Idol at the time.
He was his idol. There's no doubt about it. I mean, I think, you know, later on he denied it. But in the beginning, he was very forthcoming about that.
What would Bill Cooper be doing today if he were still alive, broadcasting and doing what he did?
Well, I don't know. That's what I was saying before. When he lived, is very important to the Bill Cooper story.
I mean, he died November 5th, 2001, 17 years ago.
It's 17 years ago. It's actually, yeah, what is it, 17, 18? Yeah, 17 years ago.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, I think that because of what he did and the fact the shortwave radio thing is very important to the William Cooper story, because to listen to a shortwave radio show is not like pushing a preset on your dashboard of your car, or just turning on the dial, you know, something like that, or going on the internet. If there's a sunspot going across the solar, you know, landscape, 93 million miles away, it messes up the signal. You can't hear it, you
know?
To listen to Bill Cooper, a lot of people told me, you know, I didn't listen to him back then. I came to him later, but the thing is, like, people would listen to Bill Cooper. They'd be sitting there waiting to hear Bill Cooper. They have their pen and pencil in hand, as Cooper always told them to do, because the information that he was going to impart was very important.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be ready to write it down, and then all of a sudden the show would go dead.
The signal was gone, yeah.
The signal was gone, and, like, that made it important. That made it important. That took it out of the realm of the everyday and put it into almost a prophetic thing, because God doesn't talk to everybody, right? So, like, you know, it's just like to be able to hear it and to listen to it as crackly, you know, like there's something about the integrity of a vinyl record when you hear those cracks and all that kind of stuff. It just makes it seem more real, you know, and I think that was part of it. That was part of it with Bill Cooper.
Let's go to Nolan in New Orleans, east of the Rockies. Hi, Nolan. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. How y'all doing? Enjoying your show.
Thank you, sir.
You know, back, I remember when they gave away the Panama Canal. I was a truck driver. I was on Claiborne Avenue in New Orleans and said, what is going on with our government? And also, when you look back at some of the other Waco and supply trains, what went on in Vietnam, they had Viet Cong supply trains not being bombed. And I started wondering about the globe. Why did this country all of a sudden became a conservative country into this, you know, hate for the protectionists back then? We were protectionists, and it was a whole nother culture back then. It was just a whole nother world. I remember my wife has an aunt, Di Martinson, and her husband Donald. They used to get mad at me because I had a book called The Elite's Planning for World Management by Holly Sklar. And she talked about Rockefeller's plan for world government. And
Holly Sklar. She was a left-wing person, though, right?
Oh, was she? You know, and it was just to the point I was learning. Well, Bill Cooper was one of the people, not my personality, but he was one of the people that fought. And I really got disgusted with my wife's aunt because I was telling people when, you know, I was driving truck about world government. One black man who was into the Bible told me, he says, yeah, it's in Revelations. They're talking about world government.
He was right.
You know? But, you know, now we used to talk about the Trilateral Commission. You couldn't mention that word. I call up Rush Limbaugh. He says, I'm in this for entertainment. I'm not into talking about the Trilateral Commission, which showed it existed. And I actually think Feinstein and the people today are trilateralists, and the conspiracy of not getting Kavanaugh in is part of this trilateral movement.
Well, that we're going to have to see what happens. The clock has got us all. Mark, I want to thank you. Good luck with the book, Pale Horse Rider. Up next, we're going to be talking about Coral Castle in Florida. Updates on just how did a 140-pound guy, Edward Leeds Scullin, make that thing.